supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Bill Cosby's retrial got underway today with the prosecution presenting its opening statement. Joining me from the Montgomery County Courthouse in Norristown is WHYY's Bobby Allen. Bobby, what did we learn today?
So, Dave, today the prosecution outlined their case in their opening statement, and starting things right off, the big news was the revelation that Cosby paid Andrea Constant nearly $3.4 million in a civil settlement that was settled in 2006, some years after Cosby allegedly sexually assaulted her. And that's really significant because we have known for a while that that civil settlement existed, but we never have known how much that amount was for. And both sides are going to use that number to their advantage. So the prosecution is going to say $3.4 million, that sure does seem to suggest that Cosby did something wrong here, and he was basically buying her silence. Whereas the defense is going to take that number and say, look, this woman, Andrea Constant, always had a money motive and framed and extorted Cosby to get rich. That's kind of their narrative, their legal approach. So the prosecution wanted to own that number, and they revealed it, and it was publicly revealed for the first time today in open court.
Bobby, I understand proceedings were disrupted for a time this morning.
That's right. So right before court got started, a woman charged at the barricade, jumped over it, and ripped off her shirt to reveal the words in bright red scrawled across her bare chest, "Women's Lives Matter," and she had the names of dozens of Cosby accusers written in black. Shortly after, this is right in front of Cosby. I'm not even sure Cosby saw her because she was swarmed with sheriff's deputies who pushed her into a bush, arrested her, and took her away. I actually interviewed her afterward, and she said she wanted to express anger that some of Cosby's accusers maybe can't express themselves. And she said she wanted to make a statement that her body is her own. She said she was doing it as a feat of empowerment to say that her body is not just a sexual object but can be a political weapon. And she was associated, she lives in Paris right now. She's originally from New Jersey, but she's an actress living in Paris, and she's associated with a feminist European organization that does a lot of topless protests as part of their activism.
Above and beyond her statement, does this question the security protocols in place?
Yeah, well, Cosby's spokesman used it as an opportunity to say that security needs to be bolstered around the courthouse and that there's a lot of people who are mugging for the cameras and might do, you know, increasingly outlandish stunts in front of Cosby to get their name on cable news. The court hasn't responded to that. The spokesman said we need more security. That's basically where that stands. There's no huge update there.
What's on tap for tomorrow?
So tomorrow we're going to hear the defense side of the story. Now, remember, opening statements are not evidence. It's just a chance for both sides to sort of broadly outline what the jurors are going to hear over the next coming weeks. The prosecution laid out all the facts the way they had before. They did it in a little more of a tight fashion. It was really more focused, and they you know, have last year's trial to learn from. So they tried to debunk a lot of things that they thought they were weak on last time around. But they really focused on the incident and just said, look, Cosby drugged and sexually molested this woman in 2004, and he got away with it. Now it's the time to convict. We're going to hear from the defense tomorrow, which is going to have a very different side of the story, which is going to be, according to court documents that I've read, that Andrea Constant is a, you know, money-hungry woman who always wanted to extort Cosby, and that most of what is in the indictment is made up.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Bobby Allen on Newsworks Tonight. For New Jersey Democratic Governor Phil Murphy to achieve his goal of legalizing recreational marijuana, he'll need allies in Congress. But as WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports, that's proving to be a heavy lift, even for some members of his state's own congressional delegation.
Governor Murphy is trying to usher through an entirely new approach to marijuana for the Garden State. at the same time when Attorney General Jeff Sessions has asked Congress to allow him to send federal agents in to bust legal medicinal and recreational marijuana business owners. Murphy says he's not worried about those prohibitionist policies. He says Congress has been able to keep them at bay thus far.
It has not impacted us, and we believe it will not, although that doesn't mean that we're not paying attention.
Murphy is already overhauling the state's medical marijuana program. Now he's working to fulfill a campaign promise to regulate weed the same way alcohol is.
We will deliberately and steadily get to the recreational side.
Central Jersey Republican Congressman Leonard Lance says he's open to part of Governor Murphy's plan.
I favor medical marijuana, but I do not favor recreational marijuana.
Why not?
I think it sends a very poor message to young people.
Lance's position is fairly common. Many Republicans are supportive of medical marijuana, but aren't ready to follow the lead of Colorado, California, and Vermont. Other Garden State Republicans are blunter in their opposition.
I think it's nuts.
That's South Jersey Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur.
It's just nuts. We're in the midst of the worst drug crisis in our history, and this new governor wants to do a social experiment and see, you know, test out whether marijuana is a gateway drug so he can raise money for the state. It's just nuts to me.
For MacArthur, it's an issue that revolves around the health of the next generation.
Everyone knows that it is particularly damaging to the developing adolescent brain. And yet he wants to rush off and make New Jersey the California of the East. Let him go be the mayor of San Francisco or the governor of California, but don't do this to the state of New Jersey.
New Jersey's junior senator, Democrat Cory Booker, dismisses MacArthur's reaction.
I think he's wildly out of step with his own state, and he should maybe look at the overwhelming popularity of decriminalizing, making it legal.
Booker is constantly floated as a potential Democratic presidential aspirant in 2020, and he's been a leading voice on Capitol Hill calling for normalizing weed. He says MacArthur is off base and that it will worsen the opioid epidemic.
It's actually what I'm hearing from doctors in Jersey and beyond is that it's an off-ramp drug that with this opioid addiction it helps people get off of drugs, so get off of opioid addiction.
Still, MacArthur is not taking a hard line against all marijuana-related changes. He says he'd like to see a criminal justice reform package that makes it easier for people with marijuana convictions to start over.
I am open to not using marijuana offenses as forcing people into the criminal justice system, because for some people they never get out of it, and it defines their entire life.
Some prominent Democrats in the New Jersey legislature are pushing decriminalization as an alternative to legalization. MacArthur says Governor Murphy would be wise to look at that seriously.
There's a lot of daylight between decriminalizing and legalizing for recreational use.
While Governor Murphy will be counting votes in Trenton to get a legalization bill passed, his support, or lack of it in Washington, matters. If he gets to sign it into law, he'll be looking to Congress for help so Washington doesn't kill off the legal pot industry before its first harvest. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When Mayor Jim Kenney stumped for a Philadelphia tax on soda and other sweetened beverages, he vowed the money would help to create 25 community schools. That goal is now 20, and the number of promised pre-K seats is 5,500, down from 6,500. Still, both initiatives are moving forward, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
Samuel Gompers Elementary in West Philadelphia was slated to close in 2013, but longtime principal Phil DeLuca wasn't hearing it.
I remember when they said, DeLuca, what are you going to do next year? Your school's closing. I said, well, first of all, I said, it's not closing. And I said, I plan on being here next year. So.
Gompers was spared and then some. Last year, it became one of the city's 12 community schools, part of the initiative that reimagines neighborhood schools as hubs for social services. But no new schools will be joining the cohort this year, says Susan Gobreski from the Mayor's Office of Education.
We currently don't have an expansion itself planned for this year. We'll make some decisions once the beverage tax is resolved.
The beverage tax revenue funds the community schools initiative, and right now it's facing a legal challenge before the state Supreme Court. The tax is also bringing in less money than predicted. All that has caused the administration to scale back its ambitions. But schools already designated as community schools are moving forward. At George Washington High School in the Northeast, site coordinator Caitlin Boyle is focusing on language training, job services, and food security for the many immigrants who now live in the surrounding community.
You do have this contingent of people that really need help, and they're asking for help, and they're wanting help, and they're such hard workers.
Boyle and her peers will also continue to work hard, even as the broader initiative faces an uncertain future. Avi Wolf-Manarant, WHYY News.
Rebound, the new book by Kwame Alexander, is the story of Charlie Bell, a budding basketball star and jazz aficionado. It's a prequel to Alexander's Newbery Award-winning children's book, The Crossover, and like the first book, it's written in poetic verse. Alexander stopped by the studio last week as he set out on a month-long book tour. I asked him how he gets kids to focus on reading in an age where many types of media compete for their attention. He responded, as he often does, in verse.
A quick shoulder shake, a slick eye fake. Number 28 is way past late. He's reading me like a book, but I turn the page and watch him look, which can only mean I got him shook. His feet are the bank, and I'm the crook. Breaking, taking him to the left. Now he's took. Number 14 joins in. Now he's on the hook. I got two in my kitchen. I'm fixing the cook. Prepping my meal, ready for glass. Nobody's expecting Filthy to pass. I see Vondi under the hoop, so I serve him up my alley.
Oop.
So I'm saying, here's the deal. I'm not going to tell you why you need to read or why this book is important or why you should be writing. What we should be doing as teachers and educators is let the words, let the books do the work for us. But we got to find those books that are going to rip the hearts out of our, you know, young people's imaginations and stomp on them. Just like the Muhammad Ali autobiography did for me when I was 12, the greatest. Like, I read that book in one night, 400 plus pages, and I could not put it down. And it made me not just be open to picking up and reading another book. It made me want to read another book. I want to write books like that that make kids want to read.
This book is in part your story, though I hope that your dad has not met the same tragic end, which was the central start of this book.
Well, I mean, yeah. So how do you talk about something that's sort of tragic and tough, and how do you deal with loss? Like, nobody's ever prepared for losing someone who's a big part of your life. And the title Rebound, it's about, you know, a basketball move. It's about getting that rebound. It's about getting that ball off the backboard so that your team has possession. It's also about what happens off the court. While I was writing Rebound, my mother got really sick and I was in the hospital, and she all but said, look, Kwame, we've had a great time together. I'm leaving. Like, she all but said that. And so while I'm writing Rebound, I realized that I'm not going to be able to finish this book if my mother dies. So I sat in the hospital room and I finished Rebound. And I got to tell you, it was very cathartic for me to be able to write that story about a kid who's dealing with that kind of heavy loss and how he has to learn how to rebound. It helped me rebound after she passed.
We've caught you as you're embarking on a 33-city tour where you're appearing, I presume, at bookstores and
libraries.
Interviews like this.
Yes.
It sounds pretty rigorous. What joy are you deriving from that? What's part of the, what's the purpose of, like, a Johnny Appleseed spreading the word?
I kind of think books are cool. I think books are fun, you know? And so I think poetry is amazing. I think it rocks. I think for so long, we've all been sort of afraid of poetry. I think children, in particular boys, have gotten a bad rap around books. I think it's my job. I feel like I am the person in charge of making books cool for kids. I want kids to get excited about books in a way that just floors us as adults. Books are like amusement parks, and sometimes kids got to be able to choose the rides. I want to provide those rides. That's why this bus, this whole Rebound bus tour, is pretty amazing, because I think it's creating that kind of energy, or at least that's my hope. And so that young people not only sort of leave these literary pep rallies, as I call them, not just wanting to read Rebound, which I hope they do, but just wanting to read a book.
This book is so much about family. You've described your family. And if you have a mentor or a teacher, whether it's a parent, an uncle, a teacher in a school, that's a wonderful thing. But for so many who don't have that avail, how is that riddle solved?
That's why I write. I write for those kids so they can know their worth, so they can see their power, so they can find their voice, so they can raise their voice. That's why I write books. And what better language to do that than through poetry, which uses so much white space? I'm not telling you everything. I'm not giving you everything. You got to read between the lines. You got to do some work. So if we can get you doing some work and getting invested and reading this book and it being a page turner, I think we got you hooked. I think we've used the right bait.
Kwame, your exuberance and your zeal is so evident, and I hope you can sustain it for the next 33 stops on your tour.
We're on day 3, so we got a ways to go. But it invigorates me. It keeps me alive. It keeps me excited. And so I'm just grateful to have had this opportunity to talk with you and feel your ebullience.
It's been a pleasure as well, and you've restored my love, not that it ever waned, of reading, basketball, and jazz. Thank you so much for being here on NewsWorks tonight.
You're very welcome.
Kwame Alexander is the author of the new book entitled Rebound. It comes on the heels of his Newbery Award-winning book, The Crossover. And you can hear much more of our conversation at WHYY.org. It's thought that a black hole exists in the center of every spiral galaxy, including our Milky Way. But what if, in addition, there were many, many, many black holes to contend with? Let's take inventory with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, one's enough. What kind of a galaxy would sport more than one?
Well, it's beginning to look like lots of large spiral galaxies might be sporting lots of black holes, indeed.
Including ours?
Including ours. In fact, there was a study done recently by a group of astrophysicists at the Columbia University who were chasing down a theory about the possibility of there being smaller black holes associated with the supermassive black hole at the core of large galaxies. Then lo and behold, in our galaxy alone, a dozen of these smaller objects were identified in close proximity to our centrally located supermassive black hole.
Does Darwin's rule exist in the cosmos, meaning over time, do the big ones eat the little ones?
Well, if we had an opportunity to really look at a large sample of galaxies, we might be able to find that something like that is going on. But this is the first time we've been able to associate really small black holes with the supermassive black holes at the cores of galaxies. So in other words, we haven't done enough of this work yet.
Now let's go from the strange to the bizarre. We've learned about the proliferation of what can't be accounted for in the universe, and we call that dark matter. Could there be a galaxy that doesn't have dark matter?
As it turns out, a group of astronomical researchers has been able to identify a galaxy that is not only extraordinarily sparse, almost transparent, but it also seems to have very little, if no, dark matter at all. When you look at galaxies and you look at the rotational velocity of galaxies, that rotational velocity cannot be accounted for by the mass that is seen. So there must be some other hidden matter there, which is how we have this term dark matter. Well, maybe we don't really understand gravity well enough to understand that it's possible for a galaxy to have this kind of rotational velocity without the matter we need to see. So then that would cause a problem for all galaxies if, you know, we thought that dark matter was everywhere, but it's not here. So that disproves that idea right there already.
From the bizarre to the mundane, with clear skies, what's available to be seen overhead this week?
Thank goodness it's all visible stuff. We have great planets. Jupiter is up in the east after 10 p.m. Saturn and Mars are in the south in the pre-dawn sky, with Jupiter in the west about to set right after sunset. You can do that too. If you happen to be up early in the morning, you'll be able to catch Saturn and Mars with Jupiter way far over on the western side of the sky. Now, in the evening, Dave, we have a great series of constellations, but particularly individual stars we should take a look for. Let's start first with a bright red star over on the western side of the sky, part of the constellation Orion the Hunter. That's Betelgeuse. It's the ninth brightest star in our sky. It's a red supergiant, and it is so big, if we were to plop it right here in the center of our solar system, its size would extend beyond the orbit of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, out past the asteroid belt, almost out to Jupiter. The next star we should take a look at is the brightest star in our sky, Sirius. It's only about 8 light-years away. It's only about twice the mass of our star, which makes it sort of on the small side. But this is a very interesting star because, as a very hot white star, it actually at one time had a companion that was a little bit bigger and a little bit brighter. We don't see it anymore because it burned through all of its energy supply much faster than its twin, and we now can only recognize it as a little tiny white dwarf tucked in very close to this bright star, Sirius.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.